In or out? The EU referendum on Cambridge 105.
Welcome to the second of our EU referendum Cambridge Decide specials. Tomorrow, the UK will be voting on whether we want to remain in or leave the European Union. Over the next 40 minutes or so, I'll be exploring the cases for Remain or Brexit. Julian Hupper is Cambridge's former Lib Dem MP. He's been telling me why he thinks Britain is stronger in.
So I think there are two separate issues here. One is, how do we make sure that there's affordable housing for people in Cambridge? And it's absolutely right, prices are too high. What we need is to change that by building more houses. That's why I've pushed really hard for us to be able to get more housing, particularly new council housing. One of the things we changed, which I was very proud to vote for when I was in Parliament, was to get rid of something called negative subsidy, where council tenants in Cambridge were paying money, which was taken away from them. Over 13 years under Labour, that cost us £250 million from Cambridge and South Cambs, which should have been going on council housing. So we need council housing, we need affordable housing, absolutely. Separately is the consequences of leaving Europe and leaving the European Union. And what that would do is not a sort of the sensible corrections to house prices to make them more affordable by having more, but a massive crisis. And we don't know how bad that would be, but it's not going to look pretty. I'd like to see houses becoming more affordable, not some gigantic crash happening suddenly, not house prices collapsing because interest rates shoot up, making it unaffordable. That's not the way forward.
Now, Lord Rose, the head of the campaign to keep Britain in the EU, said that wages of low-skilled workers could in fact rise in the event of Brexit. Now, is he wrong?
I mean, I think it's very hard to see what's going to happen. I don't think that's something people should rely on. I think we're likely to see more economic problems, and so I don't think that's likely to happen.
Was he right to say that, though?
If that's his interpretation of what's happening, then he's welcome to say that. I think the thing is that wages for low-paid workers will be affected by the national minimum wage. What we should be doing is having a proper living wage, and that would increase wages for low-paid people far more effectively, far more reliably, with no other downsides.
Is this not scaremongering, though?
So there's been a lot of talk about scaremongering throughout this campaign, and I found it frustrating because the sense I've had is that every time I try and say why I think leaving would be bad, you get attacked by people for, well, you're just scaremongering. It seems perverse to ask the British public to make a decision between A and B and say, but any time you criticise B, although that's scaremongering, that's somehow cheating. I mean, I can understand why the Remain camp don't want to talk about what Remain would look like, but it seems quite important that we actually find out what the most likely projections are, and all the reliable economic forecasts, in fact, pretty much every single economic forecast of any kind, says that we would be much worse off if we left.
Now, how can we control the free movement of people from inside the European Union? It's not really up for negotiation, is it?
Well, so I think there's a question there about whether we want to try to prevent that from happening. And I think if we stay in the European Union, or, frankly, probably if we leave, we would keep free movement of people. And that's been responsible for huge economic benefits here in this country. Again, there have been many studies which have looked at this, and migrants from Europe have contributed billions and billions of pounds into the Treasury. That's fantastic. That's billions of pounds extra that we have to pay for the NHS, to pay for transport, for all sorts of other things. So we benefit massively from those people coming here. And they do a whole range of jobs, some that people typically don't really want to do. But they also set up companies, hire loads of other people. Something like a seventh of new companies were set up by immigrants. That figure may well have changed. We benefit massively from those people coming here. So I don't want to see us end that ability, because it also applies the other way. I think it's great that people from the UK can go and live and work in France, in Germany, in Poland, wherever it is. There was a poll which said a lot of Brits say that they want Britons to be able to go and live and work freely anywhere in Europe, but Europeans shouldn't be able to come here. It's not going to work like that. So if we stay in, we will continue to benefit economically, socially, culturally from all of that. If we leave, well, this is one of the problems with the Remain idea, is we have no idea what we would leave to. Would we leave and look like many of the countries that are outside who have agreed to free movement of people in order to be able to trade with Europe? Would we leave?
Are you talking about Norway, for example?
Norway, for example. Yeah, exactly. So Norway is not inside the European Union, so it doesn't get a say, but it does have free movement of people, and it does contribute actually more money towards the European budget than we do per person. Is that the model we go for? Or would we sort of run away and have nothing to do with the European Union, which would include not having a trade deal? we have no idea what leave would actually look like, which I think means it would be a recipe for absolute chaos. I mean, can you imagine whoever's prime minister after, if we vote to leave, they won't know what they're supposed to be negotiating with Europe. Are we trying to keep in and get the trade benefits, or are we trying to run away? No idea. But fundamentally, immigration has been good for this country. There are definitely downsides from immigration.
Well, there's the stress on the NHS, for example, and the increased waiting times that we have in doctor's surgeries and in A&E, for example.
Well, actually, you are far more likely to be treated by a European immigrant than you are to have one in front of you in the queue. There's actually not that many Europeans here proportionately, but there are a lot working inside our NHS. So our NHS would fall apart if we suddenly lost all of the Europeans who come here to contribute to it. I think where there are issues are things to do with school places and housing, particularly in some areas. But it seems to me that the correct answer is to build some more houses, to make sure that the schools are big enough to deal with all the children. That's the way to tackle that problem, not just to blame the foreigners, when all the studies show overall we're much better off.
Now, the Vote Leave campaign say they want an Australian-style point system. Why wouldn't this be fairer?
I think they're just a bit confused trying to find something to say. We already have a point system, and we have a situation where people coming from outside the European Union, it's often very, very hard for them to come here. I dealt with many cases. I'm still dealing with cases of people in Cambridge who contribute substantially here, running companies, doing all sorts of things, who fall foul of silly immigration rules. And that applies whether they're from Australia, from the US, from Pakistan, anywhere. So I don't see why we want to make it harder and have even more people treated badly. So we already have a point system. If you look at Dyson, you know, he was saying how hard it was to get good engineers in from outside the European Union. Let's make it easier, not make it harder for Europeans to get here.
But he's also come out and backed the Leave campaign.
He has indeed, but his argument was very odd. Very, very odd, because what you're saying, his argument was that it's hard to get people in from outside the European Union. If he thinks it's going to suddenly become easier if we leave the European Union, that's just so unlikely. We could make it easier for key engineers to get in right now, and that's what we should be doing.
So you think the government should be doing more to decrease numbers from outside the EU?
No, I don't think that at all. I think the Home Office needs to have a much more sensitive approach to immigration policy. Currently, they do not deal with people very well, and they make it incredibly hard. It can take a huge amount of time for companies in Cambridge, for example, to get crucial staff that they need because the Home Office are slow and on many occasions, deeply incompetent. I've dealt with many cases where they've made sudden demands. You must produce your bank statement from this month within the next 14 days, and I don't care if you don't have a paper copy, then you're leaving the country. That's just ridiculous. We are better off when people from outside this country can get here to contribute to our economy, and making it harder by leaving the EU isn't going to help.
Now, currently, we discriminate against people from Australia and New Zealand in favour of people from Romania and Bulgaria, for example. Can you understand why some people see this as unfair?
Well, I think the answer is that we should stop discriminating against people from Australia and New Zealand. We should actually have a system which is much fairer to them and makes it easier for them to come here, contribute to our economy, to come and study, to work in our universities, to set up companies. That's the right way forward. We don't benefit by hitting the people who are coming from Germany, from France, from Romania, from Bulgaria. By making it harder for them, we won't magically make it better for the Aussies and the Kiwis.
Now, do you think that the free movement of people from within Europe has in turn led to a poor integration of cultures in society today?
No, I don't think so particularly. I think it's enriched our society. There are certainly people who don't integrate as much as I think it would be great if they did. I think there are certainly issues about people who don't speak English. We should certainly make it easier for people to learn to speak English while they're here. Hugely beneficial for them, as well as for all the rest of us. What we have seen is a very large amount of anti-immigrant rhetoric. And it's fascinating how much the rhetoric separates from people's real experiences. There's been lots and lots of surveys where if you ask people what are the biggest problems facing the country, they'll often say, as one of the top few things, immigration. If you ask them what are the biggest issues facing you and your family, immigration drops completely off the list. Hardly anybody actually has experience.
Why do you think that's the case?
I think it's because people have been told by some of the media, by some politicians, that immigration is a problem that is affecting them. And they believe what they read in the media. They trust some of these politicians. But actually, in their own experience, they find it harder to actually see where those actual problems are. So I think a lot of the concerns, there is genuine concern, but a lot of it's been whipped up by deeply inaccurate media reporting and by politicians like Nigel Farage, who have a particular position they wish to argue.
I just want to move on to trade now. And we currently buy more goods from the European Union than we actually sell to them. If the UK does vote Brexit, why wouldn't a free trade deal be better for the UK?
I think it's very hard to see how leaving would lead to a better deal. We would leave. We simply do not have anything like the number of people we would need, skilled trade negotiators, to renegotiate deals with the entirety of the EU and all the other countries we already have deals with through the EU. So there's, you know, if you talk to anybody who actually knows about these things, there's no way we'd be in a position to do that. There's also the issue that why would the European Union want to give us a particularly nice deal? We would be saying we want our cake and we want to eat it. Why would they agree to that? It's a bit like having a divorce and saying, I know, we'll have a much better relationship after we've divorced. We'll obviously be able to work things out much better then. It's just not how it works.
But we have been told that the Germans might put tariffs on cars that they sell us, bearing in mind we buy more cars from them than they do from us. Surely it's within their interest not to plonk huge tariffs on the cars we buy.
But firstly, they would take the attitude that if the precedent is set that you get a better deal by walking out, then everybody would walk out and everybody would be a lot worse off. So I think they're not going to take that line. But also, we are a small part of their business. They're not going to roll over for us. We, on the other hand, would be desperately in need because something like half of our exports go to the rest of Europe. So we would be the ones begging, asking for help. Why would they choose to do that? Why would they prioritise that over everything else? Why would America, we've already heard from President Obama, the US would simply not prioritise a new trade deal with us when we've caused the harm ourselves? So I think all the analyses are that we would be in a much worse position, but we still have no idea what it would look like. And that's one of the problems with the Leave campaign, is they haven't spelt out what they think it would look like. Would we go out and say, look, we'd actually like to do all the trade with the rest of Europe, so we are prepared to accept the conditions? Because there's no way Europe would agree to conditions where we say, look, we're not following any of your rules at all. So would we be like Norway, where we follow their rules, pay in, accept free movement and get no say? Or would we just walk out completely and suffer much, much worse terms? So I think it's really clear from a trade perspective. Again, pretty much every independent analysis confirms this. Huge uncertainty, huge risk. But also, the rest of the world would be looking. And a lot of companies around the world look to invest somewhere in the US, somewhere in Europe, and somewhere in Asia. Makes sense in a global world. If we walk out of Europe, they'll say, well, the point was we wanted to have a say in Europe, a presence in Europe. We've left the EU, they're going to have to move somewhere else, and that's what they'll do.
But if you look at Iceland, for example, they have a much smaller population than that of the UK and have managed to secure a free trade deal with China. Surely the UK could manage that with other countries, including the EU?
So, firstly, of course, we could set up some new deals. It would take an incredibly long time. If you look at the Icelandic deal, it took a long time to negotiate.
7 years, wasn't it?
That's a fairly long time, and that was only one, and I think we would look for a better deal, frankly, than Iceland secured. So yes, of course we could get deals. You can strike deals any time. I can sell you a car if I make it cheap enough. I'll always be able to get a deal. But that doesn't mean it's a good deal. And I'd like a good deal for Britain.
Now, the likes of Nigel Farage say we've turned our backs on our Commonwealth partners when it comes to free trade. Just like to know your thoughts on that.
Look, I mean, Nigel will, I think, say pretty much anything that fits with what he'd like to say. What's really striking is that if you look at our Commonwealth partners, if you look at Australia, New Zealand, India, all sorts of places, they're all saying we should stay in. They value the links that they have with us, partly because we are inside the European Union. So when I hear Nigel say the Aussies really want something other than what they say publicly, it doesn't seem very plausible at all. It reminds me of, I think it was Dominic Raab, Conservative MP, who said that President Obama was simply wrong about what the US trade policy was. You have to be quite confident to say that you know better what the US thinks than the President of the US, and similarly to say you know better what Australia wants than the Australian politicians.
Now, a large proportion of the big names are backing Remain. The likes of Lord Mandelson, for example, said that in the past, that if Britain didn't join the Euro, the City of London would be badly hit. Was he right?
I mean, I think the history of the Euro is a fascinating and different one. I think it's a different discussion from the one that we're having now. And certainly predictions are hard to make with great certainty. What is quite clear, though, is that leaving the European Union would be much more of a factor, because it's easy enough to see how you can work on a different currency. Yes, you have some arbitrage risk. There are some costs associated with that. But cutting ourselves out would be a much more serious change.
And another big topic within the referendum campaigning has been around sovereignty. Now, how can we have true sovereignty in the UK Parliament if a large chunk of the laws are made in Brussels?
So there's been a huge number of myths about this, and it's one of the things that I found
fascinating. Some people are saying around 70% of laws are made in Brussels.
Yeah, I mean, some people will make up any number that they want to make. If you actually look at the report that the House of Commons did, it's far, far, far smaller than that. Less than 10%. I don't have the exact figures with me. And I know people make up other numbers. And that's what I was going to say, is that one of the big problems about this referendum has been the way that particularly people on the Leave side have simply made up facts about what the current position is. We've had Boris Johnson and his comments about it's illegal under EU law to sell bananas in bunches of more than three. I mean, he's A, wrong, and B, obviously wrong, because you can see that people sell bananas in large groups. That figure about how much, how many laws are made, you know, simply made up by people. The famous 350 million figure that's been officially reprimanded as simply not being true, and yet the Leave campaign continue to use it. And I find that really frustrating. I believe in evidence. Now, predictions are always uncertain. Anybody who tries to forecast anything in 5 years' time, there's always some uncertainty about that. Absolutely. But you can be right about what's happening right now. And to see the Leave campaign simply lying repeatedly about stuff that's happening now is really frustrating. So, yes, we do have connections with the European Union. Of course we do. But it's nothing like as dominant. And my experience in Parliament certainly was that we had a lot of freedom to do things, to not do things. The number of times we were told you simply can't do this because the EU won't let us. Hardly any. Hardly any at all. And many of the things where we do have to look at what the European Union do are to do with the trade arrangements. That it's really helpful to companies here that the detailed standards for electrical implements, for example, are the same in Britain as they are in France, as they are in Germany, as they are in Denmark, and so on.
It's the same as some of the health and safety laws as well, isn't it?
It's really convenient as well. If you're making a product and you want to sell it in lots of places, you don't want a different set of rules for each place. You quite like to be able to say, right, we can make this product, we'll have two different plugs for different audiences, or three, four, whatever, but fundamentally we have to stick to the same thing. So companies want that harmony. And frankly, if we were outside, we'd probably want it anyway. So I don't think the sovereignty issue is as big as many people say. And I think there's also a question of how much influence and power you get. Do you have more sovereignty if you say, look, we're not going to talk to anybody else, we're going to go away, stand on our own, and do our own thing? Or do you have more sovereignty when you're involved with a much larger organisation, playing a leading role in it, able to shape and have much, much, much more influence? I think you get more sovereignty working with others. Otherwise, you'd say that North Korea has the most sovereignty of anywhere in the country. I'm not sure that's what we want to look like.
But the unelected commission are the ones who make the laws, and it's very difficult, if not impossible, for the UK Parliament to change any of it.
But that's not right. I mean, that's simply not true. So people talk about the unelected commission, but actually we have civil servants here. We have permanent secretaries, incredibly powerful people. We don't elect them, and none of us complain about that. And to say that they make the laws simply isn't right. There is a system where the commission plays a role, the council, which is made up of ministers from the UK and other countries, plays a role, and there's a European Parliament, which is fully elected. Unlike, for example, in the UK, where, yes, we have the House of Commons, which is elected, but we have a House of Lords, which is utterly unelected, unless you count the very, very bizarre case where some hereditary peers get to vote on which other hereditary peers get to become legislators for the rest of their lives. Actually, the UK has a much more unelected element than the European Union does.
Do you believe that Britain really does have its own unique status within Europe? And do you think the Prime Minister did do a good job with his renegotiation?
I think we absolutely do have a unique status within Europe. And it's really interesting to see what other European countries think of us. I mean, they very much see us as trying to have our cake and eat it, having huge say in what happens. For example, the rebate, billions of pounds that never leave this country. No other country gets to change the rules like that. So we do get a huge say. We have opt-outs from all sorts of things. We have all sorts of exceptional carve-outs. And I think trying to say we want all of the good things simply isn't going to work. It's a bit like going to your next job and saying, look, I'd like to be paid £200,000, but I don't really want to have to do anything. Mm. Now, that's a great deal if your boss will agree. I haven't tried it yet, but I don't think many bosses would agree.
Do you think the other EU country leaders would veto David Cameron's renegotiation after the 23rd of June?
I don't think that's very likely. What I would like to see is far more reform of the European Union than has happened so far. I think we should be in Europe reforming it, fixing it, making it better for us. There's lots that we can do, and you know, many of my colleagues have argued for many, many years, stopping this idea of having two seats. There's lots of things where we could make Europe work better. That's what we should be pushing for, and we should be trying to get all the other countries, many of whom do agree, to actually think that's the way forward.
The former Lib Dem Cambridge MP Julian Huppert there. EU referendum Cambridge decides continues in a couple of moments when I'll be speaking to the UKIP MP Douglas Carswell from Vote Leave.
In or out, the EU referendum on Cambridge 105.
Welcome back to Cambridge Decides. Let's explore the case for leaving the EU now. Douglas Carswell is UKIP's only MP in the House of Commons. I started by asking him how much he expected immigration to fall to if we left the EU.
It will certainly go down. The exact amount, we don't know, and that's because we would have the level of immigration that suited the needs of the economy. We could take control and decide how many people would come into the country. And just like Australia, every year in Australia, the government of Australia decides how many new Australians there are going to be. And it works very well for Australia. They're in their 25th consecutive year of economic growth. So we'd be able to benefit from having the labour mobility we need, the people with the skills coming in that we needed, but we would have control. We would be able to say no to the uncontrolled immigration that we have at the moment. So the number would go down, but people could decide for themselves as a country, we could decide for ourselves as a country, what that level should be.
But the non-EU figure was 188,000 last year. How on earth can you expect any government to hit any realistic target when we can't actually hit the target for the non-EU figure at the moment?
Well, we certainly can't control immigration because 500 million people have an automatic right to settle here. You're quite right. At the moment, we do have roughly 50% non-EU migration. But put it another way around, what's the point in trying to reduce immigration from non-EU countries if 500 million people have an automatic right to come here? We end up with a crazy situation we have at the moment where we're saying no to highly qualified software engineers from Singapore or medical students from India because we can't say no to people with criminal records from Eastern Europe. It's crazy.
But migration to Australia, you've touched upon Australia for the Australian-style point system, is currently higher than that of the UK. If that's the case, can you understand why people are questioning how it's possible to cut the numbers?
Not at all. Australia decides how much immigration they want. It so happens that at the moment, as a percentage of their population, they have a higher rate of net migration than we do. But equally, Australia could reduce that if they wanted to. Australia decides how many new Australians come to Australia every year. We don't have that power. We are in a position where we can't control who comes in. We can't control the numbers. And I think many of your listeners will actually be rather concerned about that. And that is a legitimate concern. People want to know that we'll have control. And the way to do that is to vote for control by voting to leave the EU on June the 23rd. Now, after we've taken control, we can then have an honest discussion about what rate of migration we should have. But it would be a British electorate, or rather a British government answerable to a British electorate, deciding that. At the moment, we don't have that power. We instead have a ludicrous position where different parties stand for election promising to reduce migration, which they can't achieve. David Cameron said he would reduce it to less than 100,000. Current net migration is running at about 300,000. We might actually be able to not just control our borders, but restore a bit of integrity to the democratic process, which many of your listeners, I think, would find lacking.
But hospitals like Addenbrooke's in Cambridge, a world-leading hospital, rely on doctors, nurses coming from EU countries to settle here and treat our patients. Cutting ourselves off from the free movement policy is surely going to have a negative impact on our NHS.
Not at all. If we were to leave the EU and control our migration policy, we would certainly want people with skills, doctors, nurses, to continue to come here. We could decide that for ourselves. I think the EU rules have actually undermined patient safety. The EU insisted, despite what the British Medical Association wanted, the EU insisted that we recognise all EU qualified doctors as though they were British qualified doctors. That has led, I think, to a reduction in some standards of clinical care. Also, the important issue of clinical trials. In many of our hospitals, as you rightly say, are leading hospitals. Many of them were leading the world in medical research, life-saving research in the treatment of cancer, multiple sclerosis, motor neuron disease, many other diseases. We, 15, 20 years ago, led the world in this, and about 12% of all the clinical trials that happened in our top teaching hospitals. Then, of course, the EU Clinical Directive came in. It was drawn up by people who didn't understand the principles of scientific research with something called the precautionary principle. It doubled the cost of clinical trials. As a consequence, many of our leading teaching hospitals and research hospitals are no longer able to do those clinical trials, and something like 1% of clinical trials now happen in the UK. So by being in the EU, not only are we not able to ensure that we attract the brightest and the best to work in the NHS, our NHS can't continue to do that life-saving science that we once led the world in.
Now, EU migrants paying more than they take out. Surely this is this something for nothing culture that's being bandied around by the Leave campaign. Isn't that realistic?
I actually think that many of the much of the analysis done about the costs and benefits of migrants are methodologically rather flawed. Migrants, like anyone else, tend to grow older, and much of the research that's been done to look at the fiscal cost implications of migration haven't taken into account the fact that migrants too will age along with everyone else in the population. Look, I think it is a valid point to recognise that many migrants tend not to be on out-of-work benefit, because many migrants do tend to come to work. Not all, but overwhelmingly most do. The issue is the in-work benefits. And I do think there is a legitimate issue about the fact that many people who come here to work have, in effect, their wages subsidized by a system of in-work benefit. It suppresses wages. It keeps wages down. And I'm not sure that it's done much to increase our productivity. So I do think there are legitimate concerns about claims on in-work benefits, and I think those claims and concerns are legitimate. In the east of England, like in other parts of the country, migration, uncontrolled large-scale migration, has without question reduced wages and living standards for many people in the country.
Now, I just want to move on to terrorism and security now. Surely cutting ourselves off from the EU means we cannot tackle terrorism and cross-border crime in the way we need to. We'd be isolating ourselves, surely.
Not true. When we decided all those years ago to open our borders up to what became the EU, we had no idea that the EU would one day open up its borders to the world. We saw last summer, and we're going to see it again this summer, a migration crisis in the Mediterranean. The Schengen Agreement means that it's very difficult to tackle some of the terrorist activity that we've seen in Europe. We're not in Schengen, but without question, the Schengen Agreement itself means that there is a risk. The former head of the security services, Richard Dearlove himself, said that Schengen was like hanging a welcoming sign over Europe. We need to take control of our borders. If we were to take control of our borders, we would be in a better position to tackle the security problems and challenges that we face. At the moment, we frankly can't even exclude people who we deem to be a risk and undesirable. EU rules make it harder for us to deport people. What we need to do is to take back control of our borders. Yes, there are dangers and challenges out there. The safer thing to do in a world of dangers and challenges and a terrorist threat is to ensure that we have proper security at our borders. We can't have that if we remain in the EU.
Are you not concerned that Britain leaving the EU would spark other member states to leave and a collapse of peace around the continent?
What makes you think that countries being self-governing democracies makes them belligerent? On the contrary, most countries around the world are not in the EU. Most countries around the world are growing rather faster than those inside the EU. And most countries around the world that aren't in the EU live at peace with their neighbours. If you say that by leaving the EU, we will flourish and thrive, and the example that we set will mean that other countries reject being controlled by Brussels, well, great. I've always taken the view that this is not a case of English John Bull nationalism against other Europeans. This is about ordinary people wanting to be able to control their lives and not have remote officials and technocrats in Brussels decide things for them. I'm convinced that the reason why the Brussels elite is so absolutely terrified of us voting to leave the EU is not so much just because we leave, but because they know that when we leave, we're going to flourish and others will want the same. But, you know, what they regard as, they call it contagion, as though this is some sort of disease. Self-government's not a disease. Self-government is a way of life, and a way of life that elevates people's living standards and makes for happy, prosperous, cooperative countries.
OK, I just want to move on to trade now. And the EU is the world's largest economy. Being part of it means we can influence it. If we leave, we haven't really got a clue what any free trade deal would look like or what the tariffs would be for us.
You asserted there that the EU is the world's largest economy. With respect, when in the 1970s we signed up to what became the EU, it certainly accounted for about 40% of world output. Since then, it's declined precipitously. At the moment, the EU economy is less than 25%. By the mid-2020s, it's estimated to be less than 15%. It's in freefall. In 2005, the year I first became an MP, just over a decade ago, two-thirds of the value of our total exports every year went to the EU. Now it's fallen from 65% down to 42%. It's such a precipitous decline, it'll probably be even lower by the end of this interview. Europe's economy is failing. The growth lies elsewhere. Every continent outside the European Union is growing faster than the European Union, with the sole exception of Antarctica. Why have we tied ourselves to the world's only declining trade bloc? The prosperity for our future lies on our ability to trade and produce things to sell to the rest of the world. That's clearly what the trade statistics show. Europe's declining with every set of trade statistics. The EU's declining with every set of trade statistics. We need to open ourselves up to the world. If we leave the EU, we can have free trade agreements, not just with the EU. We know we can have that. There's tariff-free, unrestricted trade with every country in the EU at the moment, from Iceland, non-EU Iceland, to non-EU Turkey. But the key thing is that we not only have free trade with the EU, we have trade deals with the rest of the world. Why is it that Britain today does not have a free trade agreement with Australia, with India, with China? We can have those agreements if we leave the EU. In fact, it's the EU that's holding us up. We were on the verge of having a free trade agreement with Australia till, I think, some Spanish tomato growers complained about something or other. If we are outside the EU, we'll be in a position to negotiate those arrangements globally ourselves.
Are you not concerned about President Obama's comments about being put to the back of the queue for a free trade deal with the US if a Brexit happened?
I've got a lot of respect and admiration for Barack Obama. I think he's done a lot of good things, and I think he's very popular in this country for good reason. But with great respect to Mr. Obama, I'm not sure that any American president would ever accept submitting the United States Congress to a Pan-American parliament based in Bogota, or submitting the U.S. Supreme Court to a judicial system based in Haiti. And if the United States isn't willing to subsume their democracy to that of their neighbors, why should we? Barack Obama said we would be at the back of the queue. At the moment, the United Kingdom and America are each other's great trading partners. The United States is the largest source of inward investment into this country. We do an enormous amount of trade, and that is because this is a great place to invest. Being in the EU is not the issue. What is the issue is that we are a great place to do business, and that strong relationship will continue. Sometimes the sort of elites who get together at the international shindigs in Davos every year and who all get to meet each other at the G7 summits, they forget that actually trade happens not because they're hanging out together and taking photos of one another. Trade happens because individuals and companies in different countries find it advantageous to trade. And that's going to continue whether or not politicians around the world get upset because we decide to become a self-governing country once again.
Now, EU membership has increased average UK salaries by around £1,800. For working people, that's got to be a good thing, surely.
I fundamentally disagree with your assertion. On the contrary, the evidence strongly suggests that the countries outside the European Union are growing faster. Wages are rising faster in countries that are not in the EU. We know of 27 countries of advanced industrial economic countries around the world that have increased their exports to the European single market from outside faster than we have from within. Many of your listeners will know friends, family, others who live in Australia. The standard of living for the average Australian has risen far faster than the average living standard for the average Brit or European. Being in the EU means we are in close proximity economically to a failing Eurozone. Look at the levels of unemployment in Greece, Spain, Italy. Look at the levels of debt. Look at the unresolved banking crisis. Look at the levels of youth unemployment. If we remain in the EU, we risk importing those problems into the UK. If we leave the EU, we can have the level of prosperity that people enjoy in Australia, Canada, the United States, and many other countries around the world.
But you say that, but the Centre for Economic Performance says every household would be between £850 and £1,700 worse off on average if we were to leave. I'd just like to get your thoughts on that.
Many of these think tanks and so-called experts produced similar reports saying that if we abandoned the pound and joined the euro 15 years ago, we would be better off. They were wrong then, and they're wrong now. Economists are good at some things, but one thing history tells us is that economists are not necessarily brilliant at seeing the future. I don't think we should rely on those who got it wrong on the banking crisis, those who failed to see the financial crisis and the downturn, and those who failed to recognize that the euro would be a disaster. I don't think we should be relying on them to tell us what's right for us. We know that there is a world of growth and opportunity out there. If we trade freely with the world and the European Union, and we can do both of those from outside, we will prosper. If we remain in the EU, we will be liable for future bailouts. We will be part of the world's only declining trade bloc, and we will run the risk of seeing many of the problems that are now afflicting the Eurozone being imported into this country.
Now, I think we've heard the term scaremongering more times in the last few weeks than ever before. Don't you think that the scare tactics from both sides are actually putting people off the referendum and may cause people just not bother voting on the 23rd of June?
I actually think we're going to see very high turnout on the 23rd of June. I think this campaign is actually galvanising a lot of people who recognise that actually things don't have to be this way. Things can be better. This country can be better. You're right that the other side has certainly given us an endless diet of doom and gloom. At the beginning of the campaign, I think one of them said that if we became a self-governing country, it would endanger the future of Premiership football. Then they put out a report saying house prices will go down until they realised that actually amongst younger voters that was quite a popular idea. So they put out another report saying house prices will go up. Look, David Cameron's prophesied World War III. They prophesied yesterday one of them was even saying it would be the end of Western civilization. Literally, that's what they were suggesting. I think in the absence of sensible, rational economic arguments, the other lot are resorting to hyperbole. It's up to them if they want to do it, but I think most people listening to this recognize that actually there's nothing outlandish about being a self-governing country. Most countries around the world decide their own laws, control their own borders, and most countries around the world, frankly, are growing faster than those inside the EU. The EU is a failed project. Don't listen to the people who built it. Let's look at the wider world and rejoin it.
Are you not disappointed that there hasn't been a coming together of all the different Brexit groups? There are quite a few, actually, at the moment. Surely one Brexit group is better than several.
Well, there are something like 43 million voters, and that means we need about 22 million votes to win. So one way of looking at it is to say we've got, you know, 22 million. We need 22 million people on side. Look, our side is not a homogenized, top-down, artificial team run by lobbyists and big corporate interests in London. Our campaign is a genuine grassroots campaign. And that means, as I've been going around Essex and East Anglia, I've met all sorts of different people who are campaigning to vote leave. Some of them are members of the Labour Party, some of them are members of the Conservative Party, some of them are UKIP, some of them, frankly, aren't political at all. I met someone the other day who was a pub landlord. We are a broad coalition, and that actually, in a weird way, is our strength.
And finally, after the 24th of June, are we going to see some form of a rebrand for UKIP if we vote to leave or if we vote to stay?
Political parties have their role, but this is far, far more important than any little political party or indeed any big political party. This is about whether or not, in years to come, we will be able to control the people who govern us. And frankly, that is much more significant than what it means for any one party. Political parties have a role, but this is about our democracy.
UKIP MP Douglas Carswell there. Thanks for listening to Cambridge Decides. If you're still undecided which way to vote tomorrow, do check out our website, cambridge105.fm, where you can hear my first Cambridge Decides show with Labour City Council leader Lewis Herbert for Remain and UKIP's Nick Clark for Leave. For more details about tomorrow's referendum, check out aboutmyvote.co.uk.
In or out, the EU referendum on Cambridge 105.